We want to keep some variety for our listeners.
I mean, you got about a million now.
No, we have about seven. Two of which are my parents.
And me, so we got four more. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Mom.
Hello, Mom.
I actually don't even know if she I don't think she listens.
We're going to make sure.
Yeah, I don't think she knows what a podcast is. Welcome to the second season of Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Today's guest is the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Memphis, Senior Pastor of Gifts of Life Ministries, and Founder and Managing Editor of the Rhetoric, Race, and Religion blog. Dr. Johnson was a friend of Theology Live before it even became a podcast, when it was known as This Rounds on Me. I was a huge fan of Dr. Johnson and his work before receiving my call to Grace St. Luke's 2 years ago, and have benefited greatly from his friendship. This evening, I will be interviewing Dr. Johnson at the intersection of Blackness and theology, especially as it relates to the relative and perceived quietness of white American Christianity in the era of Black Lives Matter. I am the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. So, Andre, a few weeks ago, you started a Twitter hashtag called #WhiteChurchQuiet. What does that mean, and what is its origin?
Well, you just jump right on into it, don't you?
Yes, we get straight to the point.
I thought we were just going to go slow and move on up, but first of all,
this is not a massage.
It's a good idea, actually. Theology Live and massage. Right? Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation to come and to participate again in, I think, one of the most relevant podcast going today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Seriously, and you are doing such a wonderful job. You are gifted, you are blessed by God, and I am just so honored and privileged to call you my friend. Y'all show some love again for the
Roger. I appreciate it.
So, White Church Quiet. Well, and some of you will remember this. Roughly about a month ago, maybe now, there were these another rash of killings by police of unarmed black men. Men this time, and you know this. I've been really involved in studying the movement Black Lives Matter. I've been studying it from a theological and a rhetorical point of view, and I just. Really, not then, but it was just overwhelming to see all of the response and all of the calls to justice, unity, whatever, marching and protesting or whatever. All of those calls from all of my social media accounts and even from friends here in the city of Memphis. All of those calls were coming from African Americans.
Interesting.
And I just wondered aloud this time, how come when something like this, when this injustice happened, when these injustices happen, how come we never see white ministers or white pastors or white church leaders coming behind a bank of microphones, calling for a press conference or calling on police chiefs to have meetings with the mayor and to do these type of things. Typically, if there is a church response of any sort, you know, and the black church has its own issues and problems and stuff as well, but if there's going to be a concern, it's typically usually going to come from black clergy and the black church. So White Church Quiet was my frustration, yes, but also deep concern as a minister, as a person of faith, as a Christian, as a believer, as a brother in Christ, to ask the question, where are you in this? And I know that there are individuals that have been part of the movement and have spoken out forcefully and loudly and been a part of marches and things of that nature. But as far as an institution or far as a church, I wanted to know where. And to ask the question, I think that, and the one that allowed, rather, the same thing that King in 63, the letter to the Birmingham jail, letter from the Birmingham jail, acts of white moderates of his day. You know, what are you listening to? What are you learning? What are you hearing in your churches on following Sundays? And so that's where all of this came from, and I've been having ongoing conversations with people all across the country and indeed all around the world with these Twitter chats. Usually they have been happening on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, 10 p.m. Eastern. But we're going to have more chats about that in the upcoming days and weeks. I just want to hear from white Christians about this. What is it that makes white folk not want to talk about black lives, and especially black lives, which we can pretty much, I think, agree, even if you still got some questions, you can at least say, that doesn't look right. Because now I'm talking about the videotapes. I'm not talking about the ones that are not taped, but the ones we see and we share all the time. So that's where it all came from.
Well,
elongated answer to that question.
No, that's great answer. And that gives us some context for the hashtag, the passion behind it, the inspiration for it. You know, this podcast and this event and our community is about asking big questions, mm-hmm. asking important questions, challenging questions that push us and make us better. And we've discussed race on this podcast before. We've discussed gender. We've discussed sexual orientation. We've discussed church history. We've discussed oppression of all kinds. We've defined, which is interesting, exactly what the black church is. We've talked about that before. And please go back and listen to other episodes if you have questions about that. Can you define for us what the white church is or what white Christianity is?
Wow. That's a real big question, but let me just try to sum it up. I think we just have to, can I do a little history? Just real brief. I think we're really going to have to go back because the reason why there is a black church because there was a white church that did not want black folk. So we got to just start. It wasn't like black folk did not want to come. Black folk begged to come, wanted to come, tried to come. So any denomination, any kind of church, fellowship, or whatever, we have to just go back to this whole notion of what does it mean then to practice radical hospitality or just basic hospitality? You got to go back to that. We just can't start today and just say, okay, most segregated hour is 11 o'clock. There are reasons why that are deeply rooted and deeply embedded. So when we go back and talk about white churches and how they did not want black folk worshiping, or if they allowed black folks to worship, they had to worship in the balconies, or they had to worship out back, or they had to worship in inferior spaces and places to the other white worshipers. Black folks just say, okay, good, we're just going to form our own. You know, we'll just have our own, and we can worship the way that we want to and feel the way we want to feel. You know, that's Richard Allen, right, getting up when he was not even allowed to take communion and saying, okay, we're going across the street, we'll form our own. You don't do that, though, without a theology that corresponds to that.
Interesting.
So what is the theological rationale for segregation? Oh, my God. Now we open up another big old can of worms, because now we got to talk about the belief that God made some human beings inferior No, this is just not me saying it, a preacher can say. This is God. And what do I look like trying to interfere with God's plan? And if you go back in the 18th and 19th century, some in the 20th century, especially during the civil rights era, and you read some of the sermons. I mean, one sermon that sticks out from the 60s, God, the original segregationist. And it's a proof text of all of the passages that lend themselves, if you were reading them like that, to just separation and saying, this is God's plan. Why? Without thinking the next logical step. The next logical step in that is, if God made some people just inferior, then are all people made in the image of God? And if, I just know that God made some folk inferior, and that's how God did it, that's how God did it. Well, you're also going to have to explain then that, and many did in the 19th century, so we're talking about theology now, that there were two creations. The first creation was the good one, the second one was the bad one, and they got all these bad people. Do you know that in enslavement times, there was a debate going that, I want to know, do enslaved people even have souls to save? That's a debate that we can read today, that we can actually see and the side that won was the side that said this: listen, if they become Christians, they don't have to come out of slavery. Matter of fact, it'll make them better slaves.
So you're saying that there were people who used Christianity, yes, as a kind of instrument of oppression, basically.
Right. Yes. And that's the point I'm getting at. Because
I'm sorry.
Great question. Because after that, then you have to understand that theology proper, for the longest period of time, is rooted in a belief that a group of people are not created in the image of God as other groups, and it is rooted in oppression, racism, and that theology just doesn't go away by saying, okay, today is a new day, let's start all over. One of the reasons why it's so hard for churches, and this is the hard thing for me as a pastor, and I'm going around trying to do this work, right? The hardest thing to do is to undo race and racism in churches when our theological paradigms and much of our theology is so racialized already. So, for instance, if I'm talking about empathy, compassion, and all of those things that the Christian graces, I mean, great. Those are some good things that we can actually use to unearth this demonic monster, right? But if that is already constructed as somebody's getting this and somebody's not getting that, then that's not going to help either. So what is white church is based in a theology that is at its core. Now, everybody doesn't practice it this way, but at its core, oppressive, grounded in racism and racist tropes and ideologies. And it helps shape politics, schools, businesses. It is Paul's principality and power. It is just pervasive, and it's hard to shape. And that's why people get nervous when they begin to see for the first time, because they understand that, you know, this is going to cause some issue and problems.
So tell me this. For someone hearing what you're saying, basically, maybe for the first time,
yeah,
how is what you're saying... Because it's, I mean, someone hearing this for the first time may think that you have your, this is too broad a brush that you're painting with.
Okay.
You know, why, you know, you're talking about all white Christians or all of white Christianity. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that? Like, mm-hmm. if someone says you're speaking too broadly, can you speak to
right.
that?
Right. And my question would be, all of us sinners in here, are we sinners?
We will not take a show of hands.
Right, no. And then most people would say, yeah. Are you racist? What? Why is sinners is like, oh, okay, but racist. Now, are you less racist than you were yesterday? You know, that's the whole debate that we've been talking about when Obama became president. You know, we're not in post-racial America. We hope to be less racist, but not post-racial, right? So, because it is the it is what this country was built on. I don't know what's so problematic about that. Own it and then begin to work. Because if you do not own that, at least say it, you're not talking about you yourself individually, talking about collectively now, you can then begin to work on the issue. You know, racism and race is the only issue that we think that will go away if you don't talk about it. Think about that for a moment. And when you're counseling couples or when you got issues with folks, first thing you say, let's talk about it. But when racism comes up, be quiet. Don't say anything. It's going to magically go away. And people of color as well, too, because we can ourselves identify with racial and racist characteristics. We're not, you know, blinded by this either. And begin to just own up to that, confession, right? That's part of the tradition, confess, and then begin the hard work of uprooting it day by day. We don't get it right every day. And I tell you what, let me just throw this in for free, right? I have long since argued that when we start to have these discussions, especially when white people come to the table ready to talk and ready at least to listen and to be open, listen, people of color, we need to give those folk benefit of the doubt because everybody's not at the table. And there's no need to take out frustrations on people who are at least willing to come to the table. So that is part of that. I know that's what you're going to get at is how can we, you know, begin to solve this? And one of the ways is to understand that everybody's in a different position in their own spiritual walking journeys. But if you're coming to the table and beginning to have that dialogue and beginning to understand that, that's okay. That's okay. I mean, the country is built upon the backs of enslaved people. Nobody would disagree with that, I don't think. That's okay.
There are people who disagree.
Yeah, I know, but why? But that's that denial, right? That's the so if you're, what do your therapists tell you? If you're in denial, you can't get healthy. If you deny it, you can't get healthy. So, okay. So you don't want to get healthy. That's fine. Okay. But just be aware that enlightened folk or woke folk, as we like to say now, are not wasting time anymore trying to explain this. Because what is happening is that lives are being lost on a daily basis. Injustices are happening on a daily basis. People are still using God's name for a whole lot of atrocities on a daily basis, and people are doing the work trying to, in small groups like this here, trying to get people to understand that there is another way, there is a better way, i.e. the gospel. The gospel is the counter cultural idea of its day.
I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with theologian and communication scholar, the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson. We're discussing the interplay between white Christianity, black liberation movements, and white theological complicity. So back, if we can back up just a little bit, Dr. Johnson, you got into this idea that the gospel is a countercultural kind of vision and framework. Can you say more about that? And can you say why you understand the sanctity of Black lives as being central to your theological vision?
Right. That's a great question. Two-part question. First, about the countercultural. The gospel is so, here's my little short answer to my little pithy answer for that. The gospel is so countercultural, it got Jesus executed. I know we like to say crucified, but that was the electric chair of its day. Jesus went to trial, a really messed up trial, already had it in for him, and he died. Matter of fact, the execution method that Jesus went through was so popular in its day that at least two others were going on when they put Jesus up there. That's what we learn in our gospels, right? So, you know, hey, we got room for one more. Yeah, come on, we got room for one more. So the gospel is so revolutionary that the state, Rome, with the help of a whole lot of church folk, right? The gospel is so revolutionary that the state said that this guy right here, this peasant, this poor boy, this broke, no room at the inn, nowhere to lay his head, not that, just itinerant preacher had to go. That should arrest us right there and start going back with saying, what in the world happened to make this guy get executed by the state? And then you begin to see all the things that Jesus was doing that was so counter-revolutionary, from just touching folk that were sick and hanging out with all those sinner folk and engaging in theological conversations, John 4, with women, and you know, all of this stuff that Jesus was doing so kind of so revolutionary, turning over tables. You know that when he messed with the money, he had to go then. That's the story, right? You know, Jesus, we put up with you, but when you come in here messing up the economy, you got to go. So we are part of a gospel that is so, so revolutionary, so liberating, that it got the person who kind of got it all started killed. Now, you know, it wasn't as if Jesus didn't say that this might happen. Pick up your cross, follow me. That's not a good church growth method. Anybody ready to die? Right, you know. Anybody want to take the electric chair, put it on your back? Or lethal injection needles and hang them around your neck? That's what Jesus was saying. Said, come on, let's go. We're going to Calvary. Where are we going? I don't know, Jesus. Right? So that's the short answer to that first part about countercultural. I start with Jesus, and then you can just look at the church in its earlier pre-Constantinian days. People were so sold out on Jesus that they went to, you know, they were martyred. They went, you know, holding babies in lions' dens. They worship in secret societies, secret places and spaces. Because the whole pre-Constantinian church is a refuge, scandalized church. Then when the state said, hey, you okay, gave you the rubber stamp, then we became in power. Oh. And then that's a whole nother story. So the gospel itself is kind of revolutionary. But the other part, you were talking about the intersection of really the white churches and Black lives.
Yeah, so what is your, why is the sanctity of Black lives central to your theological imagination?
I guess I'm a creationist at heart. I believe in the image of God. All of us are made in the image of God. The body is sacred.
And when you do it to the least of these, you do it unto me. All those type of things, you know. No, every now and then I have to quote scripture so people won't think I'm a heretic, you know. Don't mind me. Just throw out a scripture or two. But yeah, so that means black lives. Mm. And black lives are important right now. Because black lives are being killed and left on the streets for dead. And the big thing, I was talking to a group last week about this, the protest, can I just explain that right quick? Yes. The protest is not necessarily, even though it is horrific, the death. The protest, it grounds itself in nobody's being held accountable. So advocates of Black Lives Matter can argue, and I think very persuasively, that churches, and especially white churches, do not care enough about black bodies to even raise a concern that there is nobody being held accountable for dead black bodies. My theology said that is a sin, because that is not just the empathy and the sympathy that is afforded. That's afforded. Last week on the news, there was this dog that was a bait dog, and how people were talking about how the bait dog was being used to fight, and the dog could not defend himself because he had the muzzle, and he was just a dog that the other dog just attacked, and how people poured out concern for the dog that was still living, by the way, and was getting and got rescued, but not the same for black bodies and black lives. So, and that's a whole nother trope, equating, you know, black bodies to animals, and that's that famous sermon by Vernon Jones that, you know, when he was in Alabama, said that a person got arrested for shooting a rabbit out of season because it was not rabbit season. But it's okay to shoot Negroes because they're always in season.
Wow. 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 As we are wrapping up, would you please discuss for us, because you've alluded to this, but if you can unpack this more, can you kind of specify what forms of kind of racist theology have kind of survived to this day? Because you've alluded to that, but can you be a little more specific about that?
You know, that there is a, a belief system that is in place that, again, devalues black lives. It's so pervasive. And here's the problem. And believe me, I do understand it. I've talked to enough people, both black and white, to begin to understand where this is coming from. Because it's so pervasive that people don't even know they're doing it. You know, and in the church, it can be something as similar as all we need to do is just come together and just love, and just that meme that was going around, just forgiveness. Just let's just hug it out.
Are you referring?
You know what we're talking about, right?
So have y'all seen this meme that's been going around? Mm. So basically, a little background, and I'm sorry to take the stage on this, but I'm like a meme expert because I spend so much time on the internet. So there was this meme going around. Well, number one, someone took a picture of a bumper sticker. Yeah. That was there were two stick figures. One stick figure was a Confederate flag, and the other was a rainbow flag or like an LGBT liberation flag. the Confederate flag stick figure was kicking the rainbow flag stick figure.
Right.
Okay. No judgment on that. I won't say anything about that. So then, a few days after this was making the rounds on the internet, you know, this was a bumper sticker on someone's car that started getting passed around the internet. So like a few days ago, someone, created this meme that was basically a rainbow flag figure. So a figure symbolizing like gay liberation was hugging the Confederate flag stick figure. And under it, it just said, "Forgiveness 2016. So that's a little background on what Dr. Johnson's referring
to. Right. So that now, great explanation. Now just flip it. Racist theology is expecting black people to instantly forgive when their children have just been shot in the middle of the street. And if they don't, you do not give the degree of sympathy and empathy that you would if they did. That's a good example when we do it in Black Lives Matter, because the expectation is that you're supposed to get over this. That, you know, I will meet you halfway and say it was egregious, but what did the Lord say? Well, you could come, well, the Lord said, I shouldn't have got shot. I mean, you shouldn't have shot me either. And the only reason that you shot me is because you have a precondition to believe that black folk are inherently evil and all those other things that you can just fill in the blank. And that's problematic. And in the same breath, nobody, I know I wouldn't, but nobody else would, if the shoe was on the other foot, would even begin to expect somebody to say, you need to forgive this person. I think another, in the context of Black Lives Matter, of course, is this whole expectation of, even with videotape, we still have problems. So just going back to what I said earlier, just look at how pervasive it is. Even when you see it, it's a problem. You know, we don't have all the tape, what happened before, you know, it cut off here. Another way that this happens is that, and black people get involved in this as well. If you did not do it, if you had not acted this way, or the whole notion of blaming victim, because then that would even reflect back on parents and on family members. And they can go into a big depression, wondering if they did anything wrong. Well, what if I just would have raised them this way? Or what if I would have just said, stay at home today? And when you play those games, it's trouble.
Wow. Well, can we give Dr. Johnson a hand, please? Tucked on page 815 of the Book of Common Prayer is a prayer for the human family. In it, the petitioner asks God to do four things: take away the arrogance and hatred which infects our hearts, break down the walls that separate us, unite us in bonds of love, and work through our struggle and confusion to accomplish God's purposes on earth. As we've discussed here, none of these have happened nor will happen magically, but only through the synergy of the Holy Spirit and the sweat and energy of the church and the world. And only then will we exchange cheap unity and shoddy reconciliation for the joy of God's weighty, particular, and substantive justice. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to the staff here at Alchemy and our photographer, Mr. Josh Colfer. And to our guest, Dr. Andre Johnson, you can follow him on Twitter at A.E. Johnson, Ph.D. Join us November 9th at 6:30 at America as Dr. Zandria Robinson unpacks the previous day's election. I'm sure that will not be controversial at all. Visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events. If you have not already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you all so much. Bye, y'all.